Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. And today we talk to Anthony Bourdain. Now, he's the professional chef, TV personality, and swaggering bad boy. He's not a chef or a culinary crusader who's safe when he's in the room. But Bourdain knows the profession inside out, and he loves it. He's been in the trenches, in the kitchen, slamming out entrees on a Saturday night. He's the contrarian that we need to hear. Think of him as the dark side of the food world's warm fuzzies. So stay with us for a critical take on the food world and more this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today the Stearns unveil gorgeous Boudin sausages discovered in their native habitat of Louisiana. We see a new trend budding, egg tastings. Yes, you heard it here first. For summer veggie eating ideas, we think we should look to the country that's been eating vegetarian for centuries, India. And today we're getting those ideas from one of the people who introduced America to authentic Indian cooking years ago, Julie Sani. And then we've got Anthony Bourdain. Why is it that some people pull off outrages so adroitly that we are smitten rather than repelled? Bourdain's specialty is pulling back the curtain of the food establishment. His first book, Kitchen Confidential, got us behind the real restaurant kitchen door. He hit the road with TV, eating around the world, and he's back with another book, Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook. Tony, it has been a very long time. It's good to have you back.
Good to be with you again.
You know, at the beginning of the book, you're at a dinner with a bunch of chefs, very, very famous chefs, and you observe that not one of those people would hire you. Mm-hmm. And then you ask the question, what are you doing there? I guess this, you know, this takes me to this. How do you see yourself at this point in the world of food?
Well, I mean, for better or worse, I see myself as a, you know, this yet another overprivileged foodie, you know, with all the bad that that implies. You know, I find myself at a table with all of these great chefs taking part in sort of the grand slam of rare meals, you know, on the basis of something other than cooking. So, you know, there was a certain amount of, I don't know, discomfort with that, and also a sense of how absurd and yet wonderful it is that I would be so lucky as to find myself sitting there at a table with my heroes.
Do you see yourself as the person whose job it is to point out all the emperors are not wearing clothes?
No, absolutely not. I don't see it as my responsibility. I don't think I should be trusted, in fact, to be any kind of advocate or spokesperson or anything like that. I am a guy who's fortunate enough to not have a reputation to protect or a business to protect. I don't see myself as an ombudsman or anything like that. I think I'm too morally compromised.
You have a whole section on heroes and villains, which mm-hmm. I have to say, you know, who can resist reading this kind of opinion? But I'm going to name some names, and I'd love to know your thoughts about these people. Alice Waters.
You know, it's a continuing argument in my head, to, you know, with Alice. I like what she's saying. I just hate how she says it, when she says it, and you know, she just seems unable to say the right thing without putting her foot in her mouth right afterwards. But who could disagree with much of what she says? She's an enormously important figure in the world of food. You know, the cradle of the revolution of American dining did happen at Chez Panisse. But man, one thing after another that just seems really tone deaf.
For instance?
You know, an inability to understand that this food, this organic, sustainable food, is often much more expensive. And that this disconnect with the concerns of real working people. You know, when she says, somebody asked her about this, well, you know, why should people spend $6 for a bunch of organic grapes when it's, you know, $2 more than non-organic? And she said something like, you know, well, maybe the poor should, like, cut back on their cell phone minutes or that second pair of Nikes. I just think that was so dismissive and contemptuous and out of touch. And this is an argument that has to be won in the streets on a grassroots level. And to see someone, you know, as privileged as Alice and as out of touch saying those things again and again, I think does the cause no good.
I think I know what's coming, but I'm going to take a shot at this anyway. Food Network?
Well, obviously, you know, I'm not a big fan, but then again,
but you were on the Food phenomenon. Network, right?
Yeah, it ended badly. honestly, as much as I despise much of their programming, I think ultimately their influence has been good for the world and for me personally. I mean, they've helped empower chefs, make chefs stars, make chefs important, and make it more likely that the customers walking into a restaurant trust and are interested in the chef, whereas, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, they didn't care. Chefs were seen as service personnel. So, you know, the celebrity chef scam, as annoying as it is, I think it's on balance good for the world. So I have mixed emotions, particularly as I've become part of the problem.
How about Jamie Oliver?
I think he's good for the world. I think I really admire what he's done with his fight against childhood obesity, that he's chosen to take the probably less successful career path of annoying us, telling us things we don't want to hear, and what is probably going to be, in his lifetime at least, a losing cause. I admire that. I admire that he's doing the difficult thing, that he's an advocate for the world's health. You know, better him than me.
Mm-hmm. Gordon Ramsay?
I like Gordon. I admire him as a chef. I hate that show, Hell's Kitchen. I despise it. I think
why?
It's... because unlike Top Chef, which has a very high level of contestant, Hell's Kitchen, these are, you know, the lame, the halt, and the delusional. It's an angry British guy yelling at these poor, sad, deluded, out of shape, largely incompetent people. It's like a carnival. That's just cruel, even for me.
But don't you think the anger thing does work? In terms of the popularity?
It's a huge success. And, you know, I completely understand why Gordon's doing it. He's doing it for $250,000 an episode, as I understand it. But, I mean, you know, when there's no suspense as to, you know, who will be the executive chef of the next Gordon Ramsay restaurant, really, because I don't think any of them are up to the job. The only question is, will the morbidly obese guy who had a heart attack last season pass out before he dunks the French fries, you know?
Tony, we've got a question for you from Facebook. It's Jennifer, and I think we've got Jennifer on the line.
Hello.
Jennifer, hi.
Well, hello, Lynn. I feel very, very fortunate to be a part of this. Hello, Tony.
Hi, how you doing?
We're glad
Great.
To have you. Now, what's your question for Tony?
Tony, what do you think you might have done with your life had you not become a chef?
I could tell you what I would have liked to have done. I mean, if I could live my life over again, I would have preferred to have been Bootsy Collins and Parliament Funkadelic, their bass player. I would like to be a bass player in a funk band, but that wasn't going to happen. What was likely, had I not become a dishwasher and then a cook, to be perfectly honest, I'm sure I would have slipped into a life of petty criminality, imprisonment, and death. I mean, that's... Dishwashing saved my life. It was the first time that I went home respecting myself, respecting others, with anything to feel proud of. You know, even now, the business attracts certain personality types who sense in themselves need for immediate gratification, of quantifiable success or failure, and a general discomfort with the regular 9-to-5 job.
Jennifer, have you worked in restaurants?
No, I have not. Mm-mm. No, I always liked in Kitchen Confidential, I think it was when Tony was describing that moment, that almost that epiphany he had when he was in France with his parents. And I wonder if that had not had happened, if he still would have gone on along that culinary bend that he had gone on to. But it sounds like, in fact, you would have.
Yeah, I think for sure I would have. I got into the restaurant business for reasons completely other than food. Like, I found a tribe that would have me and mm-hmm. that I felt comfortable with. that early oyster experience certainly resonated later when I started to get serious about cooking. But I just, it came as a surprise to me that I was a proud dishwasher, that it mattered to me what my coworkers thought of my performance, that it, that was suddenly a very, very important thing.
Hey, Jennifer, thank you for calling. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Tony, thank you.
Thank you, as always. A good time.
Anthony Bourdain's author of Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook. Well, you know the dream, right? Get out of the rat race, leave the city for the country, eat brilliantly because you're raising your food the way it should be raised. Well, Tamar Haspel and her husband started doing this 2 years ago on Cape Cod. Along with the hunting, the fishing, the gardening, and by the way, making their own sea salt, Tamar raises chickens, which is why we've got her on the phone. Tamar, thanks for talking with us.
Lynn, it's good to be here.
I understand you've had a chicken experience.
I did have a chicken experience. I've had many chicken experiences, actually, since we started keeping chickens about a year ago. But this particular chicken experience involved an egg tasting. Because one of the things that happens when you have chickens is that you have eggs. And,
right,
and
right.
We were very excited about our first egg. In fact, I actually got in the car and brought it to my husband's office so we could marvel at it together. This is what dweebs we've become since we moved to the country from Manhattan. But, you know, it was delicious, and all the eggs since have been delicious. But I really wondered whether it was the experience of having your own chickens, seeing them peck happily in your yard, and the overall experience of the egg rather than just the flavor of the egg that made it taste so good. There's no question that eggs from your backyard look different than eggs from your supermarket. They're more orange. They hold together better. They're
right.
harder to beat. Everybody who's ever had a backyard egg, it's non-controversial. But do they actually taste better? So we invited friends over, including some food professionals, and, you know, we tied bandanas around their eyes, and we had four different kinds of eggs in our tasting. We had our own eggs from the backyard.
Right.
We had ordinary supermarket eggs. We had supermarket organic eggs, and then we had fancy pants organic eggs from the country hen. We soft-boiled them to the point where the whites were firm and the yolks were runny,
mm-hmm.
and we spoon-fed them to all of our guests. And the net of it was that nobody could tell the difference. All eggs got both good and bad comments. We asked people to name their favorite, and the favorite vote was split almost evenly among all of the eggs. And the overriding comment was, well, they all taste like eggs, which was my experience of them as well. But I had to confirm it. So I actually had a long interview with a poultry scientist. And apparently what was so difficult for all of us to get our minds around that these eggs actually taste the same, and there were rationalizations galore for why, you know, it isn't true.
Well, you want it to be different. It's human nature.
Of course we do. We want the eggs from the happy chickens to taste better than the eggs from the miserable chickens. It's human nature. It's understandable. But in the poultry world, the idea that all eggs taste the same is completely non-controversial. They've known it, I guess, ever since the advent of poultry science. They've done all kinds of testings. And absent visual cues, people can't tell the difference.
All right, but now wait a minute. What about the feed? That's got to affect the flavor, doesn't it?
Well, feed can influence flavor. But it's remarkable because it's only when feed has a very, very strong flavor that it can do that. So my poultry scientist mentioned omega-3 eggs. If
right.
chickens are fed marine oils, the eggs can have a fishy taste. If your chickens peck a lot at garlic and onion scraps or citrus, yes, those flavors can make their way into the egg. But what's remarkable about a chicken is that it can take this wide range of feed, which goes from conventional pellets to, you know, grass and bugs and wild herbs and whatever else they can get their little beaks into.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the great equalizers. They turn all of these things into eggs that taste exactly the same. It's actually pretty amazing.
Well, Tamar, thanks for going where no woman has gone before and for blowing a lot of beliefs out of the water. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Tamar Haspel is a food writer who's hunting and gathering on Cape Cod. You know, one of the plentiful things to hunt right now is fresh mint, which surprisingly to many makes a great dressing for hard-cooked eggs. Now, I'm talking about spearmint. We tend to think of mint by sprigs, and that's all wrong. It is not a garnish. You have to think about mint by the handfuls. It's a great player with garlic and onion and most spices. But you need a lot because you see what happens is mint pulls back when it's blended. So here's one way to use it. Do a mint garlic dressing. Take lime juice, lots of mint, garlic, onion, olive oil, and some sugar to taste. Puree it. Then drizzle that over cold seafood or greens or couscous or barley. And of course, definitely over hard-cooked eggs. Oh, and one other thing about mint. When you cook it, it fades even more. So always add fresh mint to the finished dish. That way you get two levels. So give fresh mint a try and try Jerry Traunfeld's zucchini strands with fresh mint. You're going to find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, eating veggies the Indian way. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM. American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Shane and Michael Stern track what they call sleeves-up cuisine. You know those local places where the food's good, the people are great, and the prices are right? And they tell all on their website, roadfood.com, and here with us. Hey, Jane, Michael, so what is the latest find?
Well, we have some good news about Louisiana. As you may or may not remember, Lynn, Michael and I spent a lot of time in New Orleans in the last 3 months. With the oil spill, like everybody, we are just devastated and terribly upset. And our heart goes out to everybody who, you know, is in the fishing industry or lives around there or even cares about the area. However, the good news is inland in Mamou, Louisiana, which is how far inland is that, Michael? That's about 2 hours?
Maybe a two and a half hour drive up north into Evangeline Parish, which is sort of prairie country.
We found a place called T Boy's Slaughterhouse.
Very attractive, Jane.
I know.
And the name is not an affectation. It is a slaughterhouse. I mean, pigs go in the back door, and you walk out the front door with sausage, ham, tasso ham, paunts, cracklins, and some
of the best. It's getting more attractive, Michael.
Well, this place makes what I believe to be the best Boudin sausage anywhere in Cajun country.
Now that's
very. You know
what
that is, Lynn?
Yeah, but I think you should explain it.
Okay.
Boudin sausage, formerly known as Boudin Blanc, as opposed to Boudin Noir, which you know is the darker stuff.
Right.
Boudin Blanc is ground up pork, rice, and seasonings in a natural casing. Sounds simple, but what's great about Boudin sausage, what I just especially love about it, is that there is no big corporate maker of it. There are probably 200 or more little butchers, slaughterhouses, and grocery stores that each make their own. And the variety is endless. Some varieties of Boudin are very, very spicy. Some are very moist. Some have more pork than rice.
Some are just made from crawfish.
Yeah.
There's crawfish sausage, too. But the Boudin that we're mostly talking about is made with pork. And T-Boys, it's not the hottest or spiciest, but it is in some ways the freshest, the balance of the al dente grains of rice and the moist pork in that casing with just enough spice to make it glow but not burn is, like, to me, the perfect Boudin sausage.
Now, I just have to tell you that the name of this place, T-Boy, that's the owner's name, T-Boy Burzas, right?
T-Boy Burzas, yes.
And he's an old Cajun.
He's not an old Cajun.
No, he's
a young Cajun.
A young 30-something-year-old Cajun. but from a Cajun family that's been in that area for
a long time.
Ages and ages. We thought, what a weird name. It's T, the letter T,
yeah.
Boy. And we said, what does that mean? And he said, it is the Cajun.
Well, it's short for petite boy.
Right.
But he's a big guy.
He's a huge guy. But the youngest child in a family is either T boy or T girl, which is a contraction from
the little boy. Yeah.
Right. So even though he's a, you know, football-sized T-boy now, he's still T-boy.
So do you eat the sausage there? I mean, is it a restaurant as well as a butcher shop?
Well, yes and no. It is not a restaurant, but you do eat it there. That's one of the great things about T-boys and so many of the great boudin sources is that
it's a grocery store.
It's a grocery store.
A butcher store.
And they have the sausage in a sort of in a hot box. You get it hot. He'll take a scissors and cut the links for you, and many people either stand in the store and eat it out of hand or take it out to the parking lot and spread out the butcher paper on the hood of their car and eat it there or on the dashboard. It is customary to eat boudin in the most informal way possible.
Now, is it served like on a hot dog bun? Is it garnished with anything?
There is no bun.
It's served on a piece of wax paper.
Served on a piece of paper, kind of squeeze the sausage out of the casing, or perhaps maybe if you want to be a little more formal, you get a saltine cracker to squeeze the sausage onto. But it's kind of messy, and the idea of using a knife and fork on it is really almost unheard of.
It's in the worst possible taste.
I see. Yes. So really, this is hand food of the first order.
Yes. And also, I do have to say that T-Boy makes the best crackling I have ever had in my life. And I don't know what he does, but they are...
Well, they're very spicy.
Oh, gosh, they're spicy and light and
fresh
they
just,
and
they,
delicious.
They crunch and crackle and then melt, literally, I mean literally melt on your tongue into just a slurry of spice and pork that is to die for.
And I don't know if we said this. It's in Mamou, Louisiana, which is the home of Zydeco music.
Oh, I didn't know that. Really?
Yeah, oh boy.
That is the Zydeco capital of the world.
So you can dance it all off if you hang around long
dance
enough.
While you dine.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
I love the Zydeco.
Guys, thank you.
All right, bye, Lynn.
You're welcome.
Jane and Michael's latest book is The Lexicon of Real American Food. Now, you can get their very latest finds on the website, splendidtable.org. The piece of geography that is called the Bay Area of Northern California is probably the most politicized food environment we've got. Even so, when a punk rocker named Gordon Edgar answered an ad for a cheese worker at the worker-owned Rainbow Grocery Co-op in San Francisco, he had not a clue of what was waiting in the wings. The story of punk rocker to cheese as a life's work is told in Gordon's book, Cheesemonger, A Life on the Wedge. Gordon, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Gordon, do political stances sort of come with the territory when you're working with cheese?
Well, I think political stances come with the territory when you're working with food, you know, assuming that you have some kind of political analysis first. But I think that, you know, cheese was the specific area I worked in, so of course I wanted to know how it worked politically. You know, there's a big learning curve when I first started, you know, what's the difference between a huge industrialized cheese, well, even what's the difference between a processed cheese from a natural cheese, from a small handmade cheese, and why are they all, you know, price different? How do you tell the differences? Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of issues.
You know, one of the things you mentioned in the book, too, is that you see yourself as an urban interpreter of rural life. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that when customers come in and shop in the store, especially in the Bay Area these days, you know, they want to know the story of their food. They want to know where it comes from. You know, they almost want to be entertained before they're going to buy an expensive piece of cheese. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's part of the price. You know, you get a story with your cheese once it's over $20 a pound. But I think that the trick is, you know, you can't tell everything. It, you know, you try to convey to people how much work goes into cheese, how much effort goes into being a family farmer for instance. And I think people can come away with a better understanding of that. You know, on the other hand, sometimes people really want to romanticize, you know, the noble farmer. You know, and sometimes that's not really reality either. You know, I'm not saying that people aren't, that dairy farmers aren't good people, but, you know, people make decisions to survive in this economy that has so many farmers going out of business every year. You know, so sometimes people are just, they're appalled at the fact, like, oh, why doesn't this person make their cheese with raw milk instead of pasteurized? Or why don't they grass feed all their animals? You know, and there's a lot of things that go into every farmer's decision. And, you know, some of those are economic decisions, mm-hmm. because if they don't make those economic decisions, they're not going to have a farm next year.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of a cheese that you like that embodies what you've been talking about?
Well, there's a cheese company, not a cheese in particular, but there's a farm up in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont called Jasper Hill. It's a family farm, and the mission of this farm is not just to make great cheese, which they do. The Winnemere that they make is one of my favorite cheeses in the world. It's seasonal. It's wrapped in bark. It's washed with a local lambic beer, and you get the most complex flavor of this in this cheese than pretty much almost any other cheese I've ever tasted. But what's really interesting about this company is what they did was that they invested, along with Cabot Creamery and some other foundation grants, in a huge aging facility. And why is that important? What that means is that their mission is to help save and increase family dairy farming in Vermont. So what they're doing is they're going to these farms and saying, you know, we can age your cheese for you in our facility, which means that those farmers don't have to build that facility, get their own loans, do all that kind of work. But if they make the cheese, they have a place to have it age, mm-hmm. for, you know, whether it's a month or 6 months or a year. And an expert ager, too. In France, you'd call it an affineur, but, you know, it's a cheese ager.
Right.
Who will make sure that cheese can be the best that it can be. And you know, it's a great story. And, you know, basically, if you see anything either made by Jasper Hill Farm or anything that's aged at the cellars in Jasper Hill, then, you know, it's just a fabulous cheese. And I think that one of the important things about, you know, political things about cheese is the reason it's important for farmers is dairy farmers can't control milk prices. Milk prices are set at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So if they're selling fluid milk, they can go for months selling milk at a loss and kind of hope that later in the year the price will increase and that they'll make money on it. But it's really out of their control, especially as a small dairy farm.
Right.
So if people can make cheese, it's called in the industry a value-added product. And what that means is you've had milk, which has a commodity set price, but you've made it into cheese, which means you can set your own price that can reflect your own costs and can help ensure that your family can stay on the farm. And that's one of the ways that cheese is very political and very important, and that's one of the ways that that Jasper Hill is really helping keep dairy farming alive.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Gordon. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you. I love being on the show.
Gordon Edgar's book is Cheesemonger, A Life on the Wedge. Try a shortcut approach to homemade mac and cheese with my 21st century mac and cheese. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, get registered for our free monthly book giveaway. Do you get the feeling that we want you to cook? Well, this month, the book is Nigel Slater's latest tome dedicated to the garden called Tender. You register online, splendidtable.org. Now, if you're hitting the wall on how to make your five-a-day irresistible, turn to India. I mean, you've got 3,000 years of magnificent vegetarian food, and we have a master of the Indian kitchen, author and teacher Julie Sahni. Julie, welcome. It has been far too long.
I know. Hi, Lynn.
Hello. So who's studying Indian cooking with you these days?
It's amazing. The number of Indians who have recently migrated here. These are people who have been born and raised want to learn, because India, as you know, is such a large country, so they are regional cuisines, so they don't know the cuisine of other regions. I have professionals coming, some American kids opening an Indian restaurant. So there's no hard and fast rule. Only thing is wanting to learn a cuisine which whose strength lies in spices.
Julie, in India, how do cooks handle summer vegetables?
Many ways. They eat them in the salad form. They add them to light stews. They pan roast them. And, of course, there's grilling. They grill them with light marinades. And even though people talk about tandoori cooking and tandoori vegetables, but there are other types of marinade which work kind of better for vegetables, because tandoori marinade can be somewhat heavy for vegetables.
So for instance, what kinds of things would you do?
Okay, when you're grilling vegetables, it's better to work with other aromatic, which are kind of more playful, and I always call them sexy. It's I like to...
There's nothing wrong with that. Playful, sexy, I like this.
Yeah, it's cardamom, you know. Cardamom is wonderful. Yeah. And if you add a little bit of it along with bay leaf, you combine that. And in fact, Indians prefer to use, instead of bay leaf, cinnamon leaf, which is available at Indian grocery store. It gives a delicate cinnamon flavor. So you combine these two spices with just simply some ginger, some garlic, some cilantro, and mint, or mint, and some lime juice. And I like things on a little spicier side, some green chilies. Serrano chilies would be fabulous. If you want to go milder, go with jalapeno and just blend everything up in the blender. Just before grilling, you put this concoction over your vegetables, just toss them the way you toss salad. And you lay them over the grill, and that's when you can brush them lightly with oil. You don't want to put too much oil, because that's going to wash off the marinade. I love eggplant grilled this style. And if you have a Japanese eggplant or Italian, tiny round ones, and just cut them in half, and then lengthwise, 1.5-inch pieces, and then into half again so that they're exposed. That's one way. Otherwise, diagonally, extreme diagonal, so that the exposed area is a lot. And I love eggplant. I also like cauliflower, broccoli, scallion.
You know, what occurs to me as you talk about the marinade is that would probably make a great table sauce or a dipping sauce for vegetables as well.
Oh, absolutely. And all they do is they take the marinade, and because there's nothing that needs to be cooked to be digestible, all these are herbs, and cardamom and bay leaf both are edible in their natural form. And all you add is maybe a little bit of buttermilk to it, and it gives a nice body to it, or a little yogurt.
That's a fabulous idea. Yeah. What about, is sweet corn grown in India?
Oh, I'm just going to touch upon that subject. Thank you for asking. I love Indian-style roasted corn, and I don't need a season, but summer is the time you really celebrate this here. We remove all the husk, and then we put them straight on the grill.
Right.
And straight fire roasted. And after roasting, we take lime, cut them in half, and sprinkle them with salt and chili powder, and slightly squeeze it gently underneath so that the juice comes out and kind of moistens the chili powder. And we rub that. There's no butter added, just salt and chili powder and the lime juice. It's pure heaven with that smoke smell of the freshly roasted corn. And one and two is never enough.
Julie, that really sounds great. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. Love talking about grilling.
Julie Sani has the Indian Cooking School in Brooklyn, New York, and she conducts culinary tours of India. Now, you can get Julie's recipe for grilled vegetables with garlic cardamom marinade on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, this week, the question is about the newest socio-political food designation. So, what is a femivore? Well, we'll be back in a moment with that answer. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment. You can join us on the phone at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is a femivore? Well, in today's socio-political food language, a femivore is a woman who finds her personal fulfillment by staying at home with her family, her chickens, her garden, her pressure canner, her grass-fed steer, and her spinning wheel. You get the idea. Her liberation is found not by spiraling through the glass ceiling, but by growing and sourcing food for her family that is purer than the driven snow. Feminism meets the omnivore's dilemma, and you get the femivore, the towering protector of the family. We used to have another word for this, farm woman.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
The lines are open. You can get to us, 800-537-5252, or email us, splendidtable.org. Anything goes, guys. Let's see. We've got Tom on the line from Haver City, Utah. Tom, did I pronounce that right? Haver?
Heber.
Heber. Excuse me, sir.
That's okay.
What do you want to talk about?
I had a question about shrimp. You know, there's seems to be two veins in the shrimp, kind of a dorsal vein and a ventral vein.
Yeah, top and bottom.
And oftentimes when you buy shrimp, neither of the veins are cleaned out, and then sometimes only the top one's cleaned out. And I usually clean out the bottom one too, but I'm wondering if it's necessary or what actually travels through each of those two veins.
I'm not quite – my shrimp what would you call it? My study of the shrimp skeletal
shrimp
structure.
Anatomy.
My shrimp anatomy. Thank you. That is exactly the word I was looking for. Is a little weak, but one is the digestive system.
Uh-huh.
And generally speaking, the philosophy on to vein or not to vein or devein a shrimp is the grit factor is the thing usually you're concerned about. Evidently, there's no harm that comes from eating a shrimp that has both of those things intact.
Oh.
But on a really large shrimp, it can sometimes be gritty. And that
uh-huh.
would be where you really should devein. And I'm like you. I do like to devein both sides.
Okay.
Then again, I'm a lazy soul when it comes to smaller shrimp.
It does take some time to
yeah,
devein both sides.
That's right. And the thing about it is that, you know, when you start all that deveining on a small shrimp, sometimes you end up with shred shrimp. So
yeah, sometimes you end up with shredded fingers also.
It's another problem. It's sticky, isn't it? But there are gadgets also that you just slip under the skin, under the shell rather, and you just go pop, and the whole thing comes with it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for the call.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252, or go online, splendidtable.org. Let's see, who is up next? Stephanie is on the line from Boulder, Colorado. Stephanie, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Well, I have a question. I actually just did a beer pairing dinner, which was quite fun, but I was hoping to perhaps get some other beer pairing ideas from you.
Oh, boy. I love the idea of the beer pairing dinner. And I think, if I remember, Boulder has quite a clutch of microbreweries. Am I remembering correct? Yeah, yeah. You guys are practically swimming in beer out there.
We love it.
One of the most quite stunning combinations I ever had in terms of beer and food, it was a summer wheat beer.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, now is the season. And it was served with a fresh Stilton that had candied lemon in it.
Mm.
Now, this could translate as any fresh cheese mm-hmm. with candied lemon mashed into it, like candied lemon rind.
Oh. Ooh, like perhaps like a goat cheese even?
Oh, or... you could do a goat cheese. And you know, the beer has, wheat beer can tend to have a slight sweetness along with the tart. And it works beautifully with this. The other thing you might want to think about with a wheat beer is take a fresh cheese and blend into it things like just grated fresh orange rind and shelled salted pistachio nuts.
Ooh.
And just put that, you know, on small ginger snaps or something like that. And that becomes a little summer thing that you just nibble. Yeah, I think that. Now, the other thing that's a famous combination is porter or stout, you know, which is thick, dark, bitter.
Right.
It's wonderful with bittersweet chocolate of any kind.
Yes, I actually tried it with a brownie ice cream sundae. That is, that's kind of what I did.
Wow.
But doing bittersweet is a great idea, too.
Oh, you know what that brought to mind? One of the most sensational desserts I've had in years. French restaurant in Minneapolis called Vincent. Are you familiar with the cherry beer? It's called Creek Lambic, and it comes from Belgium.
No.
Well, it's a beer that is a locally top fermented, you know, it uses wild yeast. It's sort of the beer of the Brussels area. But what they do is they make the beer and then they take the sour cherries from a nearby town that's famous for its cherries, and they macerate the cherries in that beer for like a year. And it's not sweet at all. It's so, but it sings of cherry.
Oh.
And it's available here in the United States. That beer was poured over by this chef. Are you ready for this? Okay.
Uh-huh.
Shallow glass, like a champagne, you know, coupe.
Uh-huh.
A scoop of vanilla cardamom ice cream.
Ooh.
Now, you could cheat and take really good vanilla ice cream, soften it, and work in toasted cardamom seeds,
mm-hmm,
and then
mm-hmm.
just freeze it. But the point is, that was a scoop of that, and then he poured that beer over it. It was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So now we've got dessert taken care of. The lagers and the pilsners, the pale beers, I think of them as, they're like champagne, like a really dry champagne. So anything that champagne would go with, they would go with. So that would mean, you know, Rossi food, like if anybody's eating it anymore, you know, like oysters and clams. You could imagine that having that with, you know, very light cheeses. You could imagine having that with just regular seafood that's lightly grilled. So all of that
like
would
a
be
ceviche.
A ceviche would be great. I don't do raw fish. I'm the fish police.
Okay.
I don't do raw fish. But the idea of that idea, yes, something that's tart and zingy and something that even has a chili kick to it,
right.
Those beers are going to just slice right through that. So that's some
great
basic ideas, but it sounds like you're already there.
Yes, you've given me some wonderful ideas that I can't wait to try out again.
Try that sundae, or rather that it's an ice cream soda, really. It's really fabulous. Hey,
sounds delectable. Thank you.
Thanks for a great question. Take care, Stephanie. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
We've got Jamie on the line from Wallen, Tennessee. Jamie, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have kind of an interesting little dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
I have pretty much become bored with breakfast. It seems like there are only a small number of foods that you can have for breakfast, and I've always liked a palette of different tastes, and
right.
especially multicultural foods, so I thought, well, that would be a good avenue to go down. But in all of the cookbooks that I looked in for multicultural foods, they only had maybe lunch, dinner, and dessert.
You know, you're right. You don't see breakfast mentioned when somebody's writing about the history of the food of, and, you know, all the great dishes of, I don't know, Malaysia. Yeah, you're right. They don't point out breakfast very often, do they?
No, and I was hoping to find something like that because, like I said, I love the foods of different cultures, and I was wondering if you could point me in the direction of some kind of multicultural breakfast food.
First thing that comes to mind is China, mm-hmm. because in China, one of the things that's eaten for breakfast is called congee, And our listeners who know Chinese culture are probably going to let us know very quickly that what I'm about to say might be incorrect. But congee, as I recall, is rice that's cooked until it's almost a gruel. And I'm not sure about the seasoning, but it's something you spoon. And the other thing you do also, which is really amazing, is doing something called velvet chicken or velveting chicken, where you take something like a chicken breast. You might season it with a little rice wine, perhaps even a little bit of soy sauce. And you take a knife or a cleaver and you chop it and chop it and chop it and chop it raw until it's almost like a pudding. And then that can be poached in broth very gently and you eat that. It's very nourishing. It's very warming. Now, in the summer, obviously, that's not the way to go. But you could also you could also do that and eat it at room temperature. I know that in India, you might have curry, believe it or not, you know, a spicy breakfast. And I must say, if you've never tried fresh yogurt with tamarind concentrate stirred into it, so you have really delicious fresh yogurt. Plain yogurt, and you stir in this sour, fruity, red, dark red concentrate. It is fabulous. It is just, it just wakes you up. You know, you think like, whoa. Spain, it's the little fried Crella and the most incredibly thick hot chocolate you could imagine. Mexico does a second breakfast in the middle of the morning, and the dishes are incredible. There might be eggs that are coddled. There will be tortillas. There might be fresh cheeses. There will be fresh fruit. And there may be some hot flavors in there. Although, you know what's so interesting is most Mexican food is not necessarily searing hot. But it's the idea of just bringing in from other parts of the menus for the rest of the day foods that are really beloved. So that's just some thoughts. I'm trying to think. I've heard, and I could be wrong about this, that in Vietnam, the soup that's called pho, are you familiar with it? It's spelled P-H-O.
It sounds vaguely familiar.
Okay, this is a beef broth that is spiced with star anise and cinnamon stick. You cook chunks of soup meat in it, you know, shank and that kind of thing. And then this is served with rice noodles, a ton of fresh herbs, and you might thin slice a tender cut of beef. You would only need an ounce or two. Very, very thin. And you, when you ladle the hot broth over the rice noodles, you just float that raw meat in there and it cooks in the heat of the broth. And then you add all kinds of fresh herbs. So mint, coriander, fresh chili can go into it. And you'll have that for breakfast in the heat of Vietnam, if you can imagine. And
wow.
And it is just unbelievably delicious. That's a soup I eat any hour of the night or day.
Okay.
All right. So that should get you off the dime, I think.
I think so. Thank you so much.
Aren't you glad you asked? Yes. Jamie,
definitely.
Thank you. You take care.
You too.
Bye. I have to confess, by the way, I'm not nuts about breakfast, but now I want to have breakfast. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We've got Zach from Jackson, Mississippi. Zach, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome, sir.
I am a rising junior at Vanderbilt University, and I'm majoring in psychology and Russian. And at the end of this past semester, my Russian professor invited us, myself and my other classmates, to his house, and he cooked a bunch of different dishes for us, solyanka and vinaigrette and a few other things. But my question was, could you direct me to an authentic Russian cookbook or something? Because I really enjoyed all the food, and I would just like to be able to make it myself, or at least make an attempt to make it myself.
You know, you're talking about one of the most underappreciated cuisines I think we've got, because there's fabulous food.
It really is. It really is.
Yeah, yeah. And two people come to mind. There was a book done quite a while ago by Anya von Bremsen. She's from Russia. She did something called Pleas to the Table. And this was all about the food she grew up with and much about Russian traditions. The other thing is there are two books by Dara Goldstein. Dara is a food scholar, and Dara did a book on Georgian cuisine, which was just fabulous. You know, this is the part of Russia that has some of the most extraordinary food and a lot of things like, you know, plum sauces with pepper and ground walnuts. Yeah. You know, is your mouth watering yet? Because mine
definitely.
Is. Yeah. And she did. So she did one on Georgia cuisine and then she did one on winter cuisine that was based on Russia. And for my money, the intro to that book, I still remember as being the most alluring discussion of the joys of winter eating. Those two books will really launch you.
All right. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. You are welcome. You know, they stay in my mind because it's the kind of stuff I keep going back to and getting inspired by. And that and Scandinavian food. Hey, thanks. Thanks. I sort of took a trip back.
Thank you.
You take care.
Bye.
Oh, God. You know, this is the whole thing. Scandinavian food, Russian food, and all of the former Soviet Union. You know, we don't look at these things the way we should. We get caught up in a lot of other parts of the world. Yeah, it's all there waiting. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this thought from Fran Lebowitz, who said, "Bread that must be sliced with an axe is bread that is too nourishing." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Shubha Bala. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. You have a great one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.